WTA. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
And welcome to Geeks and Writers.
And slipped right by me there. Good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. This is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today in the first and well into the second hour, you're going to hear an unaired event from September 20th, 2025, Kingston Writers Fest event, this one called Soldiers Go to War. And in it, you'll hear a conversation between moderator Eric Friesen and Lyndon McIntyre with his An Accidental Villain and Jack Wang with his The Riveter. This 91-minute discussion will run uninterrupted into, and so in this case, just a bit over halfway through the second hour. And in the bit of time that remains in the second hour following this, then you'll hear me share just a bit of information about deadlines, quickly approaching deadlines of calls for submissions and also upcoming events here and maybe a bit of other information as well. Just my usual start of the hour announcement. Occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. And let's see what else I have here. Oh, just a second announcement that I would normally tell you at the end of the hour, but because I'm not going to interrupt this long discussion, I'll just do it now. I'll mention that now. It is that you'll be hearing, let's do it this way. Let's just say a reminder that every week, how's that? I upload both hours of my personal blog of this show to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. They do remain there for 3 years. I usually get that uploaded shortly after I get home. I think I plan to be home in time to get these done by 7 o'clock this evening, our time. So hopefully it all falls together. So I'll tell you what, here we go. I'm also going to read the blurb, but let me introduce it again just in case you happen to tune in a few seconds late. This is the second. We already did the same thing last week with another event called Kingston Writers Fest event called Projections and Reflections. This one again is called Soldiers Go to War, and it is from a September 20th, 2025, Kingston Writers Fest event. Again, it is a conversation between moderator Eric Friesen and Lyndon McIntyre and Jack Wang. This, again, 91-minute discussion will run uninterrupted into and halfway through the second hour. Before I bring that up, let me just read from you. I've got their Kingston Writers Fest program guide from last year, and they have a short blurb for each of the events coming up, so I'm going to read that quickly, and then we'll just jump right into the recording. It says, Lyndon McIntyre's enthralling biography of Sir Hugh Tudor, An Accidental Villain, traces a brilliant military career turned tragic when Churchill sends him to the 1920 Irish Rebellion. Jack Wang's fictional World War II paratrooper Josiah Chang, the Riveter, serves on the front lines in hopes of earning Canadian citizenship and the right to vote. Two soldiers, one real, one fictional, caught up in the maelstroms of war and intractable prejudice. So that end quote, I should have said quote at the start. Anyway, let's just jump into it. Here we go. It was a great great event that day. I'm looking forward to this. Here you go.
And welcome to Geeks and Writers Fest. My name is Peter Gillespie, and I'm fortunate enough to be a member of the board of directors for Geeks and Writers Fest, and I'm so very pleased to introduce this event, event number 8, Soldiers Go to War. Please note our land acknowledgement on the screen in the foyer. We honor the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples who lived here before us and still call it home. And we are grateful for the opportunity to share this space that is so rich in history, language, and storytelling. In a moment, I'll introduce you to our moderator, but first a few words about the event itself. It will last for approximately an hour and a half, which will include a short question and answer period at the end. Please come forward to the mic at the center of the aisle to ask your questions. If you have mobility concerns, please raise your hand and an usher will come to assist you. I'd like to draw your attention to the Penn Canada empty chair. As we gather to celebrate our freedoms to write and to read, this vacant chair symbolizes the absence of a writer whose defense of these freedoms has led to their persecution and imprisonment. You'll find more information on the Penn Canada website. Kicks and Writers Fest would like to thank Queen's Quarterly Magazine, sponsor of this event, Doriana Basenga, author patron of Lyndon McIntyre, George Thompson, author patron of Eric Friesen, Joan Lee, Betty Lee Dagg, Tom Lee, Sally Lowe via the Henry and Loretta Lee Memorial Legacy Fund, author patron of Jack Wang. We are also grateful to the City of Kingston Arts Fund, the Ontario Arts Council, and the Canada Council for the Arts, as well as the many institutions, businesses, and individuals who support the festival. And a special thank you this year, especially to our volunteers. This year's festival is almost exclusively staffed by volunteers. People believe so thoroughly in the power of storytelling and the good it can do in our community that they're committed countless hours this weekend to bring this event to you. So thank you very much. Many of them are in this room. Thanks. Just a few housekeeping details. Please mute any devices that might ring or beep and refrain from taking pictures or recording the event. We have a wonderful festival photographer. Photographs will be posted daily on the website, so please check those out. And now it's my pleasure to introduce this afternoon's moderator, Eric Friesen. Eric got his start at CFAM Radio in Altona, Manitoba, at the tender age of 15. With his trademark voice, which I'm somewhat jealous of, he rose through the ranks of Minnesota's NPR and Canada's CBC Radio, hosting such beloved CBC programs as Studio Sparks, on stage at Glencoe Studio, and in performance. In 2019, he was awarded the Order of Canada. He is also the chair of the board of directors of Kings and Writers Fest. A lifelong book lover, Friesen has interviewed such literary luminaries as Eleanor Wachtel, Michael Chabon, Annie Proulx, Ian McEwan, Margaret Atwood, and Simon Schaman. His passion for literature and strong sense of community moved him to co-host a book club at Collins Bay Institution. In his words, "I've had murderers, drug dealers, members of the Hells Angels, and con men in that book club. Opening their minds to great stories has given them some hope. Hope for redemption, hope for a change in their lives." Please join me in welcoming Eric Friesen.
Thank you so much, Pete. He's being a little modest. He says he's on the board. He's the vice chair of the board. And hopefully someday the chair. But we'll see about that. And he also has a great radio voice, so delighted that he could introduce me. So, good afternoon, friends, and welcome to this session that many, many of us have been waiting for, entitled Soldiers Go to War. It's, of course, a perfect subject for a city like Kingston, which is a military city, which has sent off so many men and women to battle. And, of course, we also have the Royal Military College here, which has trained officers, men and women, for generations. And it's just across the causeway here. Such a joy and a pleasure to welcome to our Writers' Fest stage Lyndon McIntyre and Jack Wang. Lyndon's latest book is nonfiction, Jack's is a novel, but both fit the description, soldiers go to war. I'm going to interview them individually, and then nearer the end, we'll see if they want to engage with each other. And after that, as Pete said, we'll have a Q&A. The microphone will be right there in the middle. And after that, at 3 p.m., we will... I'm a radio guy, so we end right at 3 o'clock. Not before, not after, right at 3. I'm looking at my guys, and then, of course, they'll be out in the lobby to sign your books. And so, as I said, I'm going to interview them individually, and then I'll introduce them just before each interview that I do with them. So to determine the order in which I'll do this, the simplest and fairest way is to do it alphabetically. So since M is before W, I'll start with Lyndon. But now I'd like both of them to come to the stage. Please welcome Lyndon McIntyre and Jack. So let me start with Lyndon. Lyndon is one of those public figures who needs no introduction, but he deserves one, and he's going to get it, okay? He's no stranger to most of you from many of his roles as journalist, TV host, and published writer. Like many of our greatest writers and journalists, he's an Easterner, born in Newfoundland, raised in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. And Lyndon's dad, as he's written about, was a miner, and his mom was a teacher. Before joining the CBC, Lyndon was a print journalist for the Halifax Chronicle Herald and the Financial Times of Canada. After that, it was the CBC, first in Halifax and then in Toronto, where for many years, as most of you know, I'm sure, he was host and investigative journalist on CBC TV's The Fifth Estate. He was also a host of The Journal on radio and CBC Radio's flagship Sunday Morning. Sunday Morning on radio, The Journal on television. From writing for newspapers and broadcasting, he went on to write books, proving yet again that there is life after the CBC. His latest makes it, is it 9 books now or 10?
10.
10. 10 books in all. His latest is the one we're going to talk about. His novel, The Bishop's Man, which won the Giller Prize in 2009, and well-deserved, I might ask. And he's won dozens of prizes for his work in television and radio. He left the CBC in 2014, and it's important for you to know about him. It was 2014, it was another time of those budget cuts, many budget cuts at the corporation, and he left so that a younger journalist wouldn't get cut. A man of principle. He lives now in Toronto with his wife, who is another star of Writer's Fest, Carol Boff, who will be with us tonight. But, you know, he clearly can't hang it up. Now in his, I can say this because you're a male, he's now in his early 80s. Look at him, hale and hearty in his early 80s. Comes his new book, a work of what he calls historical journalism, an accidental villain, a soldier's tale of war, deceit, and exile. It's already a national bestseller. So, again, Lyndon McIntyre, welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
I'm very glad to be here. And since you've told everybody my age, I'm very glad. Very glad to be here.
It's on Wikipedia, so it's no secret. It's no secret. So the accidental villain you described, the man's name was Sir Hugh Tudor, Major General Sir Hugh Tudor, who after service for King and Country in the Great War and in Ireland, ended up retired on the island of Newfoundland for many decades, for the rest of his life. Who knew about this guy? But you did, or you found out. How did you find out about him?
Well, I tripped over him in a footnote. In 1941, Jack's period, the Second World War was going very badly for Winston Churchill and the Allies. They were losing, actually. And Churchill got together with Franklin Roosevelt, President of the United States. The Americans weren't in the war yet, but he was desperately lobbying to get them in. And in August of 1941, he and Churchill and Roosevelt had a meeting on a battleship off the south coast of Newfoundland. And in the middle of this really important meeting, Churchill sends word ashore. He says, I'd like to get my friend who lives in Newfoundland to come over for lunch. And the friend's name was Major General Sir Hugh Tudor. And I say to him, holy God, what kind of a friend are you going to bring into the middle of this? And what's the connection between these two guys? He lives in St. John's. Well, then I started to dig.
Uh-huh. And hence the book, eventually.
It was a tough dig, because the reason he was living in Newfoundland was because he was basically, there was no place else on the planet where he could safely even show his face. After the Irish War of Independence, in which he played a role, he was on a hit list all over the place. The IRA had him on the top of their list, maybe number two. And so he knew that he couldn't stay in England, he couldn't be anywhere in Britain. Churchill sent him out to Palestine for a little while to do some police work out there. Churchill lost office, the Lloyd George government fell, and he was unemployed in Palestine. And word was out that he was in Palestine, so he couldn't stay there. So there was no place he could go. Failing all other possibilities, he went to Newfoundland. There's a story behind why he went to Newfoundland, and it's a complex story, and it's in the book. However,
well, give us the short version.
The short version is that he was the youngest divisional commander who was promoted in the field during the First World War. He was the divisional commander of the 9th Scottish Division. British Infantry Division, and it had a number of battalions in it, and one of his battalions was made up of Newfoundlanders from the Royal Newfoundland Regiment, and they did very well. As a matter of fact, one of the members of the Royal Newfoundland Regiment won the Victoria Cross at the age of 17.
Right.
That's his name too.
That's in the book.
Anyway, it was a tremendous relationship they had. Although, I mean, he was the divisional commander of like 15,000 or 16,000 people, but these Newfoundlanders really stood out. So, at the end of his career, and there was no real safe place for him, somebody said, Newfoundland, and he'd never been there. He knew nothing. Well, what'll I do there? Well, we'll make a job for you, and they did. In the fishery, and he knew nothing about fish. And they made a job for marketing salt fish. Sir Hugh, you don't have to do anything, just be there, and we'll give you a little pension. And he got there, and again, that's part of the story. He ended up, well, he did have a job to do. And he ended up staying there for 40 years. He would sneak back to England now and then just to sort of do a little bit of fish business, but for the most of the rest of his life, he's lived in St. John's, and he didn't stray too far from there.
Well, you keep referring to the book and all the good things that are in the book. Why don't you read it?
Okay.
Set it up for us.
Okay. So Hugh Tudor ends up in Newfoundland, and I want to read a little bit from the prologue, because when I first discovered the guy, I was wondering what the heck brought him to Newfoundland, and how was he connected with Winston Churchill? So I'll read just a little bit about their connection and the crisis in his life that sent him over there.
Okay.
The broad outline of their lives, Churchill and Tudor, offers a superficial explanation of their friendship. They met as young men in a still robust British Empire, as ardent imperialists and English army officers. Both had started military careers in India and had crossed paths often as they fought in or observed the various wars of their early years. The essence of the friendship is harder to define. While Tudor shared a surname with British kings and queens, he had no genetic link to royalty or privilege. The army had offered him a departure from the conventional Tudor family experience in commerce and religion. For Churchill, the army promised the excitement of violent conflict. He had a seemingly voracious appetite for danger. War, he once insisted to his wife, was a game played with a smile. His destiny, however, was determined by his DNA and British history. War would make him famous, but his role in the conflicts that would define his legacy would be essentially political. It is possible that Churchill envied the clarity of his friend's career. He and Tudor met frequently during the First World War, when Churchill served briefly as a battalion commander on the Western Front, while Tudor was rising through the ranks as an artilleryman, soon to be the youngest divisional commander in the British Army. Their contacts at the front continued even after Churchill became a key minister in the wartime British cabinet. By the end of the Great War, Tudor had been 10 times mentioned in dispatches for gallantry in combat. He was promoted in the field to the rank of Major General. At 47, he was still young. His reputation was solid. His rank guaranteed a comfortable living, and at the end, a pension that promised a sustainable retirement. He had a young family, 4 children whom he hoped to help through all their youthful challenges and nurture to maturity. Instead, within 2 years, Tudor would be at war again, a brief war, but one that would consume his hopeful future. And in the spring of 1920, he was summoned by his oldest friend to serve the British Empire in another conflict, this one close to home, in Ireland. Churchill was by then the British Secretary of State for War. This would be a war that mocked the value of Tudor's prior military knowledge, a war that would for future generations provoke debate about who, if anybody, won it, or if in fact it ever ended. It would affect Tudor's life in ways he could not have imagined in the days of victory after November 1918, and then as leader of the occupation forces in defeated Germany. In Ireland, Major General Tudor would oversee a war for which he was personally and professionally unprepared, a war inflamed by hatred and propaganda too deeply sourced in history for conventional response. Battles fought in ditches, behind hedges, an enemy without uniforms or discipline or rules or scruples. An enemy who looked like him, who spoke his language. What he would experience in Ireland would bear little resemblance to the wars he had studied, the wars he had fought. This would be a conflict that foreshadowed a future in which citizens demanding self-determination, freedom from colonial authority and institutions, would make armies of their own, deploying their own propaganda and any form of violence that might advance their cause. His time in Ireland would mark the beginning of the end of the world as Hugh Tudor, his profession and his class, had known it. In Ireland, Tudor would be swept up by the primal energies that surface even in the most seasoned military leader when personal survival is at stake. And he would come to understand that the First World War was not, as his generation had hoped, the war to end all wars. It was, instead, the beginning of a century of conflict, wars of liberation from the past, and struggles to control the future of a world as it was being redefined by ideology. Ireland was, in many ways, a hopeless war for both the British war minister and the British soldier on the ground. They both knew they had one imperative: to win. Winston Churchill would find a way to define the outcome of the Irish War as a victory. But for Churchill's friend, the soldier, his engagement with the Irish War of Independence would be the beginning of a long journey into personal oblivion.
Wow.
That kind of sums up the book in many ways, doesn't it? But there's so much, as you say, in between. Why did Winston Churchill choose Hugh Tudor?
He had to have at his beck and call a man whose loyalty was absolutely unquestionable and unbreakable, and that could only be secured by a friend. They were very close friends, and they were mutual admirers. There were several other generals that were proposed for the job that he eventually gave to Tudor, and the other people turned it down or were just... I don't believe there was ever anybody else in mind. I think Tudor had him picked out from the days, their days at the Western
Churchill
Front.
Churchill
had Tudor picked out from their days at the Western Front. Because it took 3 days to get it through the British cabinet, and it took about another 2 days for Tudor to arrive in Ireland. And about like 10 days after that, he's in London briefing the Prime Minister on what's going to happen and how they're going to handle it. And the Prime Minister was on board. So I think it was like a lot of back-channel whispering and private conversations long before he got there.
Yeah.
But he was a man who would do what he would. He was a loyal army officer who would follow orders down to the last call, and he would do it without question. And as I reflect on his life, and as I reflect on the kind of jobs that army officers and police officers and bureaucrats are being dragged into by politicians these days, there's a sort of a cautionary tale here. Don't really behave according to the dictates of your sense of friendship and loyalty exclusively. You've got to think about what they're asking you to do.
Right. Now, Hugh Tudor doesn't lead the British Army in Ireland, does he?
He doesn't.
He leads a different kind of police force.
Well, first of all, he was made commander of the Royal Irish Constabulary, which was a police force.
Right.
Because the British government, Churchill and Lloyd George, had decided they did not want to put this under the British Army because they didn't want to call it a war. They wanted to treat it like a crime wave. They wanted to treat the revolutionaries as criminals. They didn't want to dignify it by making a war on Britain's doorstep, my God. And the other thing they were worried about was that they were terrified of the Irish diaspora in the United States, who were very politically powerful. And so they had to keep this as a police operation. But they would arm this Irish constabulary, which was basically like the Ontario Provincial Police. It was a small town, rural police force. But they would equip them as if it was an army. And they would give them a carte blanche to do whatever they had to do. And so what they decided they had to do was fight fire with fire. They studied how they were being attacked. They were being ambushed, assassinated. Their families were intimidated. Communities were intimidated. So the police said, well, that's the formula. So they started assassinating. And they started intimidating, and they started ambushing. Anybody that was perceived to be even sympathetic to the Irish War of Independence was a target. They introduced, and I'm not sure it was ever introduced anywhere else before this, they introduced this concept of communal punishment. If they have a patrol going through a little village, and somebody fires a shot, even if they don't hit anybody, the village gets torn apart. Or in rural Ireland, the backbone of the economy was a bunch of creameries where the farmers took their dairy products, small little factories. Well, they would burn the creamery. They would burn the little factory. They would burn the home of anybody who lived in a place that a shot was fired from. And they would burn the house next door just for good measure.
Yeah.
And then when somebody was actually killed in one of these other communities, they would drag somebody out of one of the houses and execute them on the ground. So this was a rough kind of a war. And people say, well, you call him an accidental villain. How did he get to be that? What's accidental about that?
Yeah.
He went in there as a disciplined officer with a conventional military background. And he brought with him a bunch of other disciplined, supposedly military officers that he could trust. And they started getting knocked off. And as one of his bureaucratic colleagues at Dublin Castle suggested, he went to Ireland with absolutely no political beliefs, he didn't care either, it could have been anywhere. But he was embittered, as they say, by the murder of his friends.
Right. And he was never in the Irish the Royal Irish Constabulary, or they were also called Black and Tans, right?
Well, there was a, once the assassination and the intimidation of Irish policemen started, they started to quit, and a lot of them were killed. And so the British government controlled the Irish police. The British government controlled all of Ireland. And so somebody got the bright idea. This was before Tudor got there. We got the bright idea, we'll put some hard guys in that in the police uniforms. So they started recruiting veterans of the First World War. Hard, unemployed, mostly English men, mostly English and Scottish people who looked down their noses at Irishmen anyway, of a different religion. They put them in police uniforms, but they hired so many of them, they ran out of uniforms. So they started cobbling together uniforms out of a combination of military and police. A sort of dark, dark, dark navy blue tunic that was basically black, and the khaki pants, and there's a black and tan. The Irish find a way to describe everything colorfully.
Yeah. And it seems like Hugh Tudor was never really in charge of them. I mean, he couldn't control them.
Well, that's what happens. And this is the story that should be taken seriously by police officers and military. Once you turn supposedly disciplined people who are employees of the state and in uniforms and conventionally trained, once you turn them loose to fight fire with fire to do what they have to do to win, all kinds of nastiness comes out. So that a police, you know, like a police station would lose one of its guys. He'd be out patrolling the street, he'd be murdered, and they would just go cut loose, and he couldn't do much about that. He would send, and then after a little while, he'd decide, oh, this is what works. I'm not going to rein them in. I'm going to have to make public noises that I disapprove, because questions are being asked in Parliament. What were the police doing? They burned down the business district of Cork, right, the third largest city in Ireland. They burned that out, a bunch of police officers. So there were questions being asked. So Tudor had to send out the memo. I disapprove of this lawlessness, of course, and you must be disciplined, even when you and there was one horrible case. William Butler Yeats wrote a poem that refers to this. It was a young Irish woman, like 21 years old, sitting out in front of her the croft that she lived in with her child on her lap, and a bunch of these cops drove by in a vehicle, and they were firing off their rifles. And one of them decided to shoot her, and shot her, killed her. And so this created an uproar. So the memo comes out afterwards. None of this firing rifles and guns in the air as you drive through populated places, unless you're aiming to shoot somebody. And surely you weren't aiming to shoot this mom. A few days after that, a little girl, 8 years old, was playing with her friend, and this was an army crowd. And see, the army started to pick up these bad habits from the police. And the army tried to arrest somebody. He ran away, and they shot at him, and they hit the 8-year-old girl and killed her. And the bullet passed over and into the 6-year-old girl. Didn't kill her. But, I mean, these things, I can go on and on. But there was a serious attack by the IRA on British officers. Famous Bloody Sunday, right, in 1920, and they murdered 16 British officers, mostly. That afternoon, there was a scheduled police action at an Irish football game. All sort of Irish Republicans at this was Gaelic football. And so they had this bright idea, they were going to send the police into this football match and start searching people to take away weapons and arrest wanted. There were a number of people wanted. They'll all be at this football match. So they send the police in there, and the first thing the police do is they get into the stadium and they start shooting people. Just. And of course, the first shot that is fired, you don't know who fired it. So their excuse was, well, somebody shot at us. No, you shot at somebody, and then all the other cops in the crowd started to shoot at civilians. And they killed 16 more people. So there were questions to be asked. So, the man was never, like, that General Tudor escaped the kind of of oversight. He escaped the kind of accountability that you would normally expect, because the politicians, they had to curtail the accountability before it leaked over onto the political side.
Right.
And then it would be problematical, both in Britain and the United States.
And he always defended his...
He did. And this goes back to his tradition as a divisional commander. And in the big world war, on the battlefield, you stood up for your troops. You held them to a disciplinary standard, but when you had to make a choice about, you know, punishment or kind of laying blame, you give them the doubt, and you stood up with them. He had a reputation, and he did that with his policemen in Ireland too. Yeah. They did horrific things, and he would make excuses for them.
Right.
And so they stayed in support. And when he went out to Palestine to do police work out there, 800 of these guys volunteered to go with him.
They came, the Black and Tans.
The Black and Tans went out
to Ireland. Palestine.
And the funny thing is, I'm not going to eat Jack, I'm going to talk to him, you know. I mean, there was a big concern that if word got out in the world that he was sending these awful Black and Tans to Palestine, where they had problems, they didn't want to create the impression that they're using these terror thugs out there. So they kept the lid on that, except that the word leaked out, as it usually does. Black man, the Palestine, oh my God. The fact was, when that word leaked out, everything in Palestine calmed down. we don't want to cross these guys. And it turned out they didn't really have to do. They didn't have to shoot anybody in Palestine. Right. They just take out their guns and beat them with their gun stocks and beat them with sticks. But that was the way. That was a big improvement over Ireland, where their sure instinct was to shoot folks.
But Tudor wasn't in Palestine very long.
No, well, he was in Palestine for about a year and a half, or so, and he'd have been there for the rest of his career, except. The politician that sent him there, Winston Churchill, lost an election. The government fell. And by now, Churchill, a lot of people skeptical of Churchill and or of Tudor and his tactics and the Black and Tans, and they just wanted to get them off the stage. And so they fired him, basically. And they kept the police officers. With him gone, they lost that identification.
Right.
But he's stranded there.
Yeah.
And he's abandoned his family.
Yeah.
Which is another fascinating aspect of this story. Totally estranged from a wife and four young kids. He can't go home again, basically. And there's really no safety.
And it's a public scandal too.
And the marriage bust up was scandalous in a small way. I mean, not like the scandals we are now accustomed to. It was a pretty Mickey Mouse scandal. He asked her for a divorce, and she said no. And back in those days, if one party says no, then it's a mess. Then there's no divorce happening. So anyway, that they're out in the papers, and that was scandalous. So he suddenly, like, he's socially, personally stranded, and his life is in danger. And somebody came up with a bright idea. There's one place where nobody's going to bother you. And that's still the case, you can believe. You don't know, man, with any sins on your soul. And you're okay.
So he's there for what, 40?
40 years.
40 years.
And he and Churchill, every time Churchill wrote a book, and he wrote a lot of books, he would send one faithfully to his friend, autographed from Winston. They kept up a big correspondence for the 40 years.
Were you able to see that?
Thank God. Like, Tudor, one of the things that made this a difficult book to write was that he didn't write a memoir about Newfoundland. He didn't keep diaries. He had a fairly vivid diary of the First World War, but nothing in Newfoundland. He didn't keep personal correspondence. People he wrote to, the only person he really wrote to was Churchill. And those letters are in the Churchill archive at Cambridge University. So get in there. And I got enough out of that to kind of get a picture of him as he aged. And as he aged, he started to reveal bigotry and racism and stuff like that, which I suspect was part of the baggage he carried in earlier life. One of the great research, as if anybody here is writing books, that are nonfiction. The newspaper, the world was full of newspapers back in the day. And so many new, like Newfoundland had about five or six newspapers going all the time, and those newspapers get get archived. And once you get into them, you like I discovered that Tudor left had two grandsons. Nobody knew that because he left the family, and nobody knew what ever happened to them. He had two grandsons, and I found one of them.
Did you?
I did. Very lovely 90-something-year-old fellow who didn't have a whole lot, but his mother had been collecting stuff about her father, and that was available. And I discovered this delightful woman in St. John's who was a close personal friend who had arranged his funeral in 1965, whose father had been his lawyer. She was 100, when I met her, she was 100 years old. She's now 103 years old, and she's reading the book as we speak. And I'm terrified. I'm frightened to death because there were a couple of things she told me. She says, now, this is just between you and me and the gatepost. I said, there's no gatepost. I'm writing a book. Never you mind now. This is just between you and me. And she blurted. And it's in the book. And she's going to find it there.
Never trust a journalist. The journalist is never your friend.
You tell the journalist, just as being you and me, it's going to be in the paper or the book or on the radio or whatever.
I'm going to go over to Jack in just
that's
a moment.
Time.
But he does. He dies in Newfoundland, right?
He dies in Newfoundland. He died 9 months and one day after Churchill died.
And he was invited to Churchill's funeral.
And he was invited to Churchill's funeral, yeah. But
he couldn't go. He was too ill by this point.
94 years old at the time.
Yeah. Great story. What a great story.
And
so, Jack, now it's your turn. Welcome.
Thank you.
Canadian novelist and short story writer, Jack is the author of the award-winning short story collection We Two Alone. He's won several awards, including an award from the Writers Union of Canada for Best Debut Collection in English, and he was shortlisted for a bunch of others. And now comes his new novel called The Riveter, just published by House of Anansi Press, and is getting a lot of attention. Jack is originally from Vancouver. He has a Bachelor of Science degree from the University of Toronto, and an MFA in fiction from the University of Arizona, and a PhD in English from Florida State University. He has held a writing fellowship at the University of East Anglia in Norwich, England. And in 2022, he served as a writer in residence at the historic Joy Kogawa House in Vancouver. He's now a professor, has been for some time, in the Department of Writing at Ithaca College. He lives in Ithaca, New York, just about 3 hours' drive from here, with his wife and their two daughters. So, Jack, welcome to Writer's Pass.
Thank you. Thank you all so much for being here. I'm absolutely delighted to be in Kingston. My only regret is that everyone on stage has a radio voice except for me. I just have an ordinary voice. I'll do my best.
It's a pretty good voice. It's a bold and full voice. So, it's great. Now, the first detail of your bio that really stuck out for me was that Bachelor of Science degree. Mm-hmm. Did you derail your chosen profession at some point to become a writer?
I did, in fact. So I was actually recounting this story with some friends I had dinner with last night, friends who live in Kingston that I hadn't seen in about 30 years. But this is my origin story, is that when I was in my first year at the University of Toronto, I thought I was going to go into the life sciences. And I did, in fact, wind up with a major in biology. But I was taking calculus, and the only problem was I could not understand calculus to save my life. So halfway through the first year, I dropped calculus. And in the spring, I took a course called Simply the Short Story. And that's when I really got turned on to the power of literature and slowly started to move in the direction of writing from the things I had imagined for myself up until that point.
Right. Well, we're glad you did.
Thank you.
I'm sure somebody's missing you out there somewhere in the field of life sciences, but we're not. We're not, especially those of us who have written your work. So your new novel called The Riveter, a very special soldier story and a love story. The story begins in 1942. The key character, the Riveter, is named Josiah Chang.
That's right.
A young Chinese Canadian. He arrives in Vancouver after working in a logging camp in the Cariboo. As a Chinese Canadian without citizenship, he's not allowed to serve in the armed forces and the fight against Hitler. So instead, he becomes a riveter, working in a in a big ship building plant in Vancouver, making victory ships for the war effort. So why is he not allowed to join up, Jack?
Yeah, as you mentioned, at the time of the Second World War, Chinese Canadians didn't have citizenship in the franchise. Remember at the time that those who had citizenship were British subjects? There wasn't Canadian citizenship per se until the Canadian Citizenship Act of 1947. But people of Chinese descent couldn't be British subjects. And at the very outset of the war, some were admitted to the what was called the militia. But eventually, Chinese Canadians were barred. I think both Ottawa and Victoria understood that if Chinese Canadians served, they could leverage their service for citizenship in the franchise, and especially in British Columbia, where the numbers of Chinese Canadians were greatest. The government didn't want an influx of voters of Chinese descent. And so understand that because Chinese Canadians didn't have citizenship, they were barred from all kinds of professions because one had to be a citizen to join a professional society, the Royal College of Physicians, right? There was a Royal Teachers College, to be any kind of professional, a pharmacist, a lawyer, you had to have citizenship. And so Chinese Canadians were not just barred from military service, but from many aspects of Canadian life. But at the time, many Chinese Canadians saw service as an opportunity. They wanted very much to serve, to prove their loyalty, in hopes that they would become Canadians in full standing.
Now, in the shipyard, where Jack is a riveter and a very good one, he falls in love
right.
with a young woman named Poppy Miller,
right.
not Chinese.
Right.
No. So tell us a bit about this affair and how it complicated his life.
Sure. So I think I first got the spark for the character of Poppy Miller when I was doing research on the shipyards. And understand that at the time there were a lot of strictures around men and women working together in the shipyards. Effectively, there was gender segregation. Women had their own lunch rooms. There were lots of rules about modesty. Women had to cover their hair. Yes, because it could be dangerous to have long hair, but also for the sake of modesty. And despite all of these strictures, I was reading about a shipyard wherein a young woman emerged from a doorway. And a few moments later, a man came out of the same doorway. And it was clear that they had just done something untoward, something indiscreet, behind said doorway. And to me, that was the first germ of this character, a woman who had this kind of sexual daring and this sense of sexual freedom in an age where this was, very much looked down on, this kind of sexual expression. And so that was the first spark of inspiration. And Josiah Chang meets Poppy Miller in the shipyard. This is an age, of course, where interracial relationships were not only rare, right, but also frowned upon. And ultimately, and I don't want to give away too much, but ultimately, Josiah's desire to serve has less to do with his hatred of the enemy or necessarily his
desire to win citizenship in the franchise, except to the extent that it will allow him to marry her and to be with the person that he loves. And so love really becomes the motivation for service.
Right, so he ends up leaving her in Vancouver and going to Toronto, where he actually manages to enlist.
Right.
And tell us about how he, in what service, what particular battalion he enlists, and some of the whole color around the rest of his time during the war.
Sure. So Josiah Chang has a few inspirations. One is Richard Marr. He was the only Chinese Canadian who served in the famed 1st Canadian Parachute Battalion. This is a very famed battalion that served in Normandy, served in Belgium and Holland, and then jumped into Germany in the final assault on the Reich. And I was fascinated by the fact that a person of Chinese descent served in this incredibly decorated military unit. And I read a book called The Dragon and the Maple Leaf by Marjorie Wong. It's kind of an exhaustive compendium of every Chinese Canadian who served in both the First and Second World Wars. But because there are hundreds of names, there's only a little bit of information on each. And so what I knew about Richard Marr was that he was born in Victoria, that he had actually not jumped in Normandy, as my character does, but did serve in Belgium and Holland and jumped into Germany. And that he trained, really interestingly to me, at Fort Benning in Georgia, because Canada didn't have a jump school at the time. I think we also have to remember paratrooping in general was a fairly new military phenomenon during the Second World War. And Canada didn't have a jump school until we built Camp Shiloh in Manitoba later on in the war. So Canadians went down to Fort Benning, Georgia. It so happens that I went to Florida State, as you mentioned, and I still visit my in-laws who live in Florida. So on one visit, I drove up to Fort Benning, Georgia to do research. And the jump towers, these 250-foot jump towers from which parachutes, men in strapped to parachutes are dropped to practice landings, they're still there. The World War, the one in Camp Shiloh is gone, but the ones in Eubanks Field in Fort Benning, Georgia, they're still there. So I got to see the jump towers. I got to see American paratroopers coming down something called the Mock Tower, which is a 35-foot jump tower with a cable that paratroopers slide down to simulate landings. Many of the techniques for training are the same as during the Second World War. And so it was fascinating to follow in the footsteps of Richard Marr. And eventually he joins his battalion in England. They trained the British way, which was different from the American way. Jumping out of C-47s, they could go out a side door. Those were spacious planes. They had a backup chute. But when they jumped the British way, they they had to jump out of these tiny converted bombers, and they had to go through a hatch in the floor where a floor turret had been, and they removed it. And so that hatch was so small that they couldn't afford the backup chute anymore when they were going through. So to jump the British way meant you didn't have a backup chute anymore. And yes, the Canadians were also concerned about this when they found out. There was consternation that they had to forego the backup chute. But there was a very long wait for the Canadians, a very long and anxious wait through the winter and so on for the weather to get better and for, of course, June 6, 1944 to arrive.
So that's a perfect cue for you to read from the book. Give us a sense of your prose style.
I'm going to read from the very beginning, also the prologue. I'm going to need my reading glasses. Lyndon, I'm impressed by your vision. I need your reading glasses here. Prologue, the riveter, prologue. For their final meal, the men had feasted on mutton and pork, and now they were sorry. All that food sat roiling inside them as their transport plane, and Albemarle pitched and rolled in the dark. A night of buffeting winds, plus the wash of other Albemarles flying in formation. Every so often, the plane would drop and their stomachs lurch. During field exercises, the same man had always been first to retch. But in an unusual show of restraint, he had traded his dinner for cigarettes. Now they all waited to see who would do the honors instead. The men had to squat on the floor of the cabin, under the weight of all their gear, the parachutes and the leg kit bags, every conceivable pocket crammed full of ammunition. With every dip and roll, they fought to stay upright. The whole plane roared with the gargling drone of the engines and stank oil and gas and human tinctures, body odor, bad breath, and effluvium from all that mutton and pork, not to mention a miasma of cigarette smoke. Soon, it would smell even worse. Josiah Chang had an iron stomach, but even he had to close his eyes to settle the waves of nausea. In that more complete darkness, he pictured her face, or tried to, a face he knew so well, it somehow seemed to be forgetting. She had thin brows and heavy lids and dimples like wounds. Yet each time he tried to train his mind's eye, her features eluded him, darting away like minnows. He wasn't here for king and country, but for her. The plane continued to buck and bounce, a tin can batted around by a bear. The men felt green, swirled like flasks. It was only a matter of time before someone lost it, and sure enough, someone did, though it wasn't clear who. And the spatter, and the taint, and the endless motion proved too much for the man beside him, and the one after that. And so came the chain reaction, men falling like dominoes, until the whole cabin was filled with a violent gastric stench. Only a few managed to find their air sickness bags in time. As the plane staggered, runnels of vomit slid across the floor. When the gruel lapped his boots, Josiah tasted bile, but managed to choke it down. The Albemarles flew in threes, arrowheads whistling through the dark. Arrow upon arrow, one after another, a magnificent storm, an armada. To avoid detection, they flew low, skimming the ocean. To achieve surprise, they had shied away from the target before wheeling around and taking an indirect approach, prolonging the flight. Men were cramping, their muscles on fire. They longed to stand, to stretch out the pain, to throw themselves out of that fuselage with all possible haste. From somewhere came the distant sound of thunder. The floor door opened, letting in a bracing rush of air, the cleansing breath of God himself, which meant they were nearing the coast of France, Normandy. The plane began to shed altitude. Every man was alone now, in the silent vault of his skull, indulging whatever gave him succor, memory, prayer, incantation. Josiah thought of her, wanted desperately to see her again. But even if he made it through this, would she still be his? Outside, kettle drums sounded, a menacing overture, and the windows began to flash white. The fighter escort had engaged, the whining dive of engines, the prattle of machine gun fire. And all the while, those drums, boom, boom, boom. The red light came on, casting its oddly sensual glow. The jumpmaster ordered the men to hook up, and they clipped their static lines to the cable that ran the length of the cabin. Josiah was in the back of the plane, 10 out of 10 in the stick. He would be last man out. The sky began to fill with bursting black clouds of anti-aircraft fire. To the forces already battering them, the wind and the wash, was now added the spanking of flak. The plane jounced and pieces of shrapnel tore through the cabin, through the tender membranes of the floor and the ceiling, leaving holes that emitted weird beams of light. But somehow no one was hit. In the carnival of chance that was war, their luck was golden. But the crucible was getting hot, and pilots were already panicking, peeling off or climbing away from the danger. This wasn't going to be the orderly drop of exercises with the maximum number of men in the smallest possible space. No, they were going to be scattered all over the fucking place.